Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. When it comes to understanding the truth about political institutions, power, and corruption, the best advice was famously offered during the Watergate investigation: follow the money. That's precisely what journalist and author Jason Berry has done in his latest book, Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church.
Berry is well known for his work, Lead Us Not Into Temptation, which chronicled the devastating sex abuse cases in the Catholic Church and the pattern of cover-up by church leaders. Now he's turned his investigative lens onto the world of Vatican finances.
With more than a billion members, the Roman Catholic Church is the world's largest organization, and it's one of the richest, thanks to donations every Sunday. The Vatican has never revealed its true worth, and yet each week, the faithful turn over tens of millions of dollars to the church, with no public oversight and no questions asked.
So after they drop their dollars into the basket, where does the money go? How much gets siphoned off by local priests and bishops? And how much goes to Rome? And how is the complete lack of transparency about Vatican finances affecting the faith and membership in the Catholic Church?
These are just some of the questions that Jason Berry explores in his new book, and it's the focus of our talker today. We'll be taking your calls in just a moment. But first, Jason Berry, welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Anthony. Great to be here.
So the book is called Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church. As we just mentioned in the introduction, you've written extensively about the clergy sex abuse scandal. How did that story lead you to this huge examination of church finances?
Well, I was struck by two things in the aftermath of the onslaught of media coverage beginning here in Boston in 2002. One was the dioceses that were taking Chapter 11 protection in bankruptcy in cases involving mass settlements with victims. And the other, frankly, was the vigil movement that began here in Boston in 2004 when people began sleeping in churches rather than, leaving so that the archbishop could sell them. And what really struck me was the contrast between the values that people had in affirming sacred spaces as part of their lives and the raw, cold economics of it. Let me give you one quick snapshot.
Sure.
There's a parish out in the middle of Ohio in the Farm Belt. The town is called Kansas, Ohio. Mm-hmm. The parish is St. James, Kansas. Bishop Blair of Toledo announced that he was going to suppress the church. This is the same canon law device used here in Boston by Archbishop, now Cardinal O'Malley, and Bishop Lennon under him, which means that the bishop literally owns the parish and can do what he wants with it. They had about $78,000 in the bank in this parish out in Ohio, and the parishioners did not want their parish suppressed. So they raised $100,000 to fight it through the courts, and the judge in Columbus eventually ruled the bishop holds the power. The bishop used the cash reserves of the parish, the $78,000, to pay his lawyers. And after he won, he demolished the church.
Oh, boy.
That kind of raw use of power is part of the financial scandal of the church, in my judgment.
Well, let me pick up, and there's so many directions I'd like to go in this, but you mentioned the power of the bishops, and you describe the, when you talk about the financial structure of the church, the enormous financial clout and power of the individual bishops have, right?
Indeed.
Yeah, can you talk about that? I mean, they have limited accountability. They're the chief money raiser, tax collector, the central banker. They're sort of all rolled into one.
Well, you're absolutely right. I didn't know that until I began this research. But think about it. Would you like the IRS to be in charge of your ATM card?
Right.
That's sort of the dual role that the bishop has. He is both the banker and the tax collector. Most parishes pay somewhere from 5 to 10%. Of the collections each week, to the diocese or archdiocese, as the case may be. In some places, wealthier parishes will pay proportionally more. But the bishop has enormous latitude to do what he wants. And, of course, what happened here in Boston is that many of these churches were closed in the aftermath of the abuse settlements in 2003, really to plug operating deficits.
Mm-hmm. And this is the connection, right, with the sex abuse crisis. That is, the church, over the course of many years, had to shell out close to $2 billion. So they had to raise money, which is why they had to sell these properties. And that's why, that's sort of this connection, I guess, between this financial picture that you've put together and the sex abuse scandal.
Well, up to a point, yes. But the real mystery here, and I spent a long time doing the research on this, is that we don't really know how much Cardinal Law spent in the 90s, and that is really the missing piece here.
Hmm. How much he spent on the payout to the...
How much he spent in not just in payments to abuse victims who then had to sign non-disclosure clauses. This went on throughout the 90s, but also how much he spent on pensions and psychological and medical care for the priests who were removed from their positions, or in some cases recycled.
Hmm. And this really gets to the heart of another sort of focus of your book, and that is the Holy See's true net worth. You write, it's invisible. I mean, we don't know what it is, right?
Well, that's quite correct. The Holy See issues a financial statement every summer. Oddly enough, right about the time of Peter's Pence, which is taken for the Pope's own charitable uses. In 2009, Peter's Pence came to roughly $82 million. All the research I did, after not getting much cooperation from church officials, finally yielded a figure of $8.5 million as what they paid out for charitable works, $250,000, as an example, rebuilding a school in Haiti. That doesn't mean that the other 80% roughly of Peter's Pence was ill-used. It's just that they don't tell us where the money went. Very quick historical note for you. For most of its history in the last century, Peter's Pence went to plug the Vatican operating deficit. So, yes, it's an invisible economy. The Vatican Bank, which has assets of a level we really don't know, is not on the books of the financial statement the Holy See releases every year. Last year, they had $30 million impounded on allegations of money laundering. The money has since been returned, and the Pope has named an advisory board to oversee the bank.
And where this really sort of touches the lives and the pocketbooks, I guess, of individual Catholics is the money that they put in that basket every week. We don't even know exactly what that figure is, right?
Well, the figures actually have been pretty consistent in the United States over the Sunday collection plates, and they actually went up by at least $200 million over the 6-year period of the abuse crisis itself. Most of the money that Catholics donate goes to the parish.
Mm-hmm.
The question then becomes whether the parishes themselves are well run.
Right.
In some cases, they are. When a pastor has a financial advisory board and works closely with it, it usually tends to be pretty harmonious. But roughly $2 billion has been embezzled from Sunday collection plates over the last 45 years.
And how do we know that? You mean it's just missing? Or?
Oh, no. There's abundant news coverage of this. There have been all kinds of cases of priests, lay workers who've been prosecuted. What we don't know is how much they recouped from insurance. But I quote at some length Michael Ryan, who lives in Milton, Massachusetts, and is an authority on finances of the church and has done extensive research in this area.
Mm. You have some great, some really shocking examples of this kind of embezzlement, and I can pick one at random here. You talk about, for example, the 1990s Cardinal Anthony Bevilacqua of Philadelphia, who was implicated in the sex abuse scandal. He spent $5 million renovating a church-owned vacation home. On the Jersey Shore, his own residence. Meanwhile, he closed 15 inner-city parishes because of a $1.2 million deficit.
Yeah, I think most people who followed that felt it was callous, to say the least, and sort of an example of the kind of misjudgment. But the core theme of this book is that the Vatican does not have a justice system, and cardinals who betray the trust or misuse funds are rarely removed from their positions, and even if they are, they remain cardinals or bishops. Quick example for you. While people in Boston were sleeping in the pews, starting in 2004, of these vigil churches, Cardinal Angelo Sodano, the Vatican Secretary of State, assisted his nephew in Italy, Andrea Sodano, a building engineer, in a startup company called Raffaello Group. And Raffaello Follieri, it's called the Follieri Group, stationed himself in New York and began scouting for churches to buy low and sell high.
Wow.
Yeah. Cardinal Sodano installed in the Vatican office that oversees church property liquidations a Monsignor who began feeding information to these men. There was a third Vatican employee involved. Finally, the FBI got wind, moved in. Follieri was indicted. He is now serving a federal prison term in the United States. And Sodano's nephew and the other two men are considered unindicted co-conspirators by the FBI. And yet, if Pope Benedict, God forbid, were to die tomorrow, Cardinal Sodano, as the dean of the College of Cardinals, would be in charge of the conclave.
Well, there we have it. Jason Berry is author of Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church. And listeners, here's the question. What do you make of the way the Catholic Church handles its finances? What do you make of what you hear Jason Berry talking about? If you're a Catholic, should the church open up its books? Do you still make donations every week? And do you feel comfortable that your money is being put to good use? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. To talk to Jason Berry. Jason, you mentioned that you said it, you put it this way, that the Vatican doesn't have a justice system. Why not? Is it that Rome, you know, is complicit in this, or is this just neglect, or is there some concern in Rome that they understand how the system works? These guys were pastors once themselves, and they know how it works at the local level.
Well, I would say all of the above, and I would add something to that. The tribunal system in the Vatican is an antique form of justice. Many of the briefs, for example, in the Congregation for the Clergy, the office that oversees the liquidation of assets around the world, when people protest, the briefs have to be in Latin. There are no open hearings. There is no judge sitting there. There are no juries. This is an entirely top-down procedural undertaking. And in those tribunals, such as the one that Cardinal Ratzinger presided over before he became pope in the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, everything is done, you know, with paperwork. And finally, if someone does have an opportunity to defend himself, say, on charges of errant theology, they listen. The documents go back and forth, but ultimately it is not a system of justice that relies on the wisdom of jurors or of one's peers. It is so top-heavy and tilted toward bishops and cardinals as to be deeply flawed. Bishops and cardinals have a de facto immunity from prosecution in the church. And that is the core of the problem. That's why Cardinal Law, after presiding over such a disaster here in Boston, spent a brief penitential period at a convent in Maryland with a group of nuns, and then got his, you know, famous job in Rome at the Basilica, making $12,000 a month.
I wanted to talk to you about one of the characters that shows up in your book. He's a Bostonian named Peter Bore. He's a Boston Catholic who became a critic of the church. He wasn't a passionate activist to begin with, but he really becomes a tough critic of the church, and you follow him throughout much of the book. What got him going in this fight?
Well, Peter Bore fascinated me from the moment we began communicating on the telephone, because he was not in any way a typical quote-unquote church reformer. This guy was a retired oil man. He'd made a great deal of money. He'd lived around the world. As he put it, the three institutions that shaped him were the United States Navy, Harvard College, and the Roman Catholic Church, in that order. Peter actually spent a great deal of his formative years in Rome. His father was an attorney with the Marshall Plan. He got mad when his parish was closed, St. Catherine of Siena in Charlestown, and he began studying the finances, such as had been disclosed at that point. And as more and more financial statements were posted, he began to see irregularities and inconsistencies. And as he traveled, moved around the city and met with people who were determined to preserve their parishes, he got involved and became the leader of the group and has made numerous trips back and forth to Rome. Much of the book is about the way he navigates through the Vatican legal system. And having done some legal reporting myself, I was sort of fascinated with how that arcane, labyrinthine system works.
Is there any indication in Rome from the reporting that you did that showed up in this book that indicates that the folks in Rome, in the Vatican, see this as a problem and want to create a little more openness and I guess, create an institution that is less monarchical?
I don't know about the last part, but there is certainly there are certainly signs that people in the Signatura, which is the Supreme Court of the Holy See, recognize that this is becoming a major issue. Again, referring to Barre, he has had some success in pushing these appeals, which have to be written in Latin by a canonist in Rome who is paid by his American clients, parishioners. And basically what is happening, slowly we're starting to see that some of these churches, they won't overrule the bishop when he closes a church, but instead of allowing him to sell it, the Vatican is saying, well, these are sacred spaces. You cannot change them to profane use, i.e., meaning you can't sell it. So it's created, I don't mean to use a cliche, but a sort of legal limbo where the parish is closed, but it can't be sold, and people try to negotiate limited use for it.
We're talking to Jason Berry. He's the author of Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church. Listeners, what do you make of what you hear? What do you think of the way the Catholic Church handles its finances? If you're a Catholic, what's your experience? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jason Berry, what has to happen? It seems like your book makes a pretty explicit point that it's up to lay Catholics to demand change. You mentioned Peter Barre. It's very much what he's doing. Is that the solution of what you see as the big problem here?
Well, the problem is so large that I frankly was daunted at the end of the book and resisted putting out a 4 or 5 point program for reform. There's a group called Future Church that is led by a nun in Cleveland, Sister Christine Schenck, who in my view is a genuine visionary. And the work that she and her group have done, they have a website with a lot of literature materials on it, I think is pointing the way. The first thing is that, a church parish has closed on average once a week for the last 15 years. Some of this is indeed related to the abuse crisis, but much of it is not. There have been major demographic changes in the United States. And pastors are the fundraisers of the church. So when you don't have enough pastors to go around, we've got this acute shortage of priests. What do you do? Future Church, I think, has made the very legitimate recommendation that they open ministry to married men and to women. Now, of course, this is anathema to some of the high officials in the church. But I think if more bishops would sit down and talk to people who want to see the church become rejuvenated, then sooner or later, if there is any collegiality left, then the word goes back to the Pope. But it has to come from below and be recognized and embraced by those in the hierarchy.
Well, let's take a couple of calls. We've got some callers standing by. Joe Ellen is calling from Shirley. Hi, Joe Ellen.
Hi. I went to Catholic institutions for 16 years. I got my bachelor's degree and had been in Catholic education all along. I'm at a pretty cynical remove from the church, and I just want to offer that I don't think the church should keep books simply because the church shouldn't have money. They have forgotten the message of the Bible, that when Jesus threw the merchants out of the temple, and that the early peoples met in humble groups, and they did for each other. The church has grown to a place where Jesus wouldn't recognize it.
Well, Joellen, thank you so much for the call. Let me ask you, Jason, about the spirit of Joellen's call, and that is this idea of the church's original role of doing good works. I mean, how do you talk about this in the book? Where's the balance?
Well, it's a very powerful statement that she made, and certainly the early church was a primitive organization that grew slowly over several centuries. But we have to remember that the church does enormous work in helping poor people, homeless venues, soup kitchens, and the like. You know, if Catholic Charities USA were to fold tomorrow, the American social safety net would literally go with it. The church, as a provider of social services to the poor, is one of the largest, engines of charitable work that we have in this country. And I would never want to see that, be eliminated. Accountability is another issue altogether, and Catholic Charities in most dioceses tends to be, fairly well run. How the bishop runs the books otherwise. But I must say one thing in fairness to Cardinal O'Malley here in Boston. The financial statements that this archdiocese posts are among the best in the country. Very few other dioceses or archdioceses post financial statements as detailed as this one.
Let's get another call from Tom, who's calling from Townsend. Hi, Tom, you're on the air. Are you there, Tom?
Hello?
Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I can barely hear you, but my point I wanted to make was is Cardinal Law being hidden in the Vatican, and for what he has done of hiding the pedophiles and transferring them around the country, and he should be brought back to the United States and face prosecution under the RICO Act. I was Catholic, and I don't intend to go back. It's not the religion that I'm discomforted with. It's just a lot of the behind the scenes and how everything is being coming to light, and it really hurts, to have this taken out from underneath you.
I can understand, Tom, and I'm really grateful for your call, and I want to pick up that point, but let me get one more thought here from Jack as well, who's calling from Plimpton. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for my call. Hey, listen, the reason I'm Catholic and very upset over the sex abuse thing, of course, but the problem with the parishes is that when they send out these requests for money, if they give them a quota and the parish doesn't meet it, if they can't get enough contributions, then that's got to come out of the parish treasury somewhere. And the amount of money they're using to build these mausoleums they call churches is crazy.
So a lot of wasteful spending, it sounds like you're talking about,
it's
Jack.
It's crazy. They're going in the wrong direction. And I'd like to have someone who is maybe higher up in the church answer that, because everybody thinks that, well, if we don't give the money, it's okay. But it's got to come out of each parish, and that's why they're going broke.
Well, Jack, thanks for that call. And Jason Berry, let me get a quick sort of closing thought from you responding to Jack. Our time is almost up.
He makes a good point that parishes increasingly are being called upon to help the diocesan or archdiocesan offices, as the case may be, when they can't generate enough support. But look, as Catholics, we have been raised in a culture of passivity to pray, pay, and obey. And a lot of people who still go to church are resisting paying because they don't like the terms of obedience. And that's kind of where the crisis is at this point.
Well, Jason Berry, it's a work of astonishing sweep, and thank you very much for coming in and talking about it. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure indeed.
That's Jason Berry. He's author of Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church. He'll be appearing tonight at St. James, the Great Church in Wellesley this evening, and you can find more information about that on our website at radioboston.org. You can also continue the conversation about finances in the Catholic Church at radioboston.org. And stay with us. Still ahead, our weekend picks for art and culture in and around Boston, and a visit with the Swingle Singers. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. $1, $1 bill, yo. Cash.